supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It comes from Citgo and its nearly 8,000 locally owned stations, donating heating oil to more than a million Americans. Citgo, there at every turn.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. We're talking about chronic illness today, and we know it causes a major disruption in the lives of millions of us Americans who have one. It affects a person's independence, often appearance, certainly their ability to do physical things. As a result, you can imagine the emotions it causes: anxiety, alienation, loneliness, stress, not just to the individual, but to families and friends as well. Well, on today's show, we're going to hear from Dr. Linda Welsh, who joins me here in the studio. She's the director of the Agoraphobia and Anxiety Treatment Center in Bala Cynwyd. She's also co-director of professionalism education at Hospital University of Pennsylvania. She's also got her own story of chronic illness. Linda, welcome back to Voices.
Thank you, Dan. Glad to be here.
We're also be joined on the telephone by Susan McDaniel. She's director of the University of Rochester's Institute for the Family in the Department of Psychiatry there. She's also author of the book Counseling with Families with Chronic Illness. Susan, welcome to the show. Susan? We have you, Susan?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we'll also
be here.
We'll also hear from two women whose lives are forever altered as a result of chronic illness, and hopefully we'll hear from you. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Susan, you do a lot of research, but, you know, there's as many types of chronic illness as there are types of families, so I would imagine it's tough to make any generalizations when we talk about the impact of chronic illness on the family.
Certainly, research always focuses in on one chronic illness, but I think there are some commonalities. You mentioned in your introduction that an illness really usually is a family affair. If you have diabetes, if you're disabled in some way, if you have asthma, hypertension, families at least worry about the person with the illness, and often they're involved in helping the person with the illness manage it.
So a lot of your research is about what happens if families do get involved or if families don't get involved.
That's right. We really have found in my research, but also in many other people's, that involving family members in, for example, a physician or nurse practitioner visit can really help make it more likely that people are able to follow the treatment plan. First of all, they may help make the treatment plan realistic. And secondly, it's just a second set of ears and can help the person take their medication appropriately. And it was shown some time ago, for example, with hypertension, that including a family member, significant other, in a physician visit could really help the actual outcomes and even the rate of death and really lower that.
Linda, I know you have very strong feelings about this, about advocacy and how patients need advocates, whether they're family members or not, but your passion about this is based on your own story.
My own experience was living in a family that was attacked, I guess, in the early stages for sure by chronic illness when my husband developed end-stage renal disease and children were quite young and we were both starting out on our careers, and we spent most of our married life struggling with what I called this guest in the house or this terrorist, however you wanted to label it on any given day, that changed our lives completely.
So where did your interest, passion for advocacy come from?
Well, here I was, a psychologist who's supposed to be fairly savvy about the emotional impact of major crises on families, but I recognized in dealing with it with my own family that it was a very lonely, alienated, as you mentioned earlier, isolating experience, and I was a novice at what to do with the medical system in that situation and could have used a tremendous amount of help both from families and friends and from the system, but didn't know how to ask or find it.
Right. And like you said, you were a psychologist and you were an adult. You had experiences with the medical system. So let's go back to you, Susan. The impact of chronic illness on spouses or partners, this is a trauma in the literal sense of the word. So what's the fallout?
It really is a trauma, and I think that it's a trauma that sometimes brings couples together, but it also can drive couples apart. And I think the experience really deserves, you know, our health care should be comprehensive. Our health care providers should be thinking about the psychosocial impact of all kinds of accidents and chronic illnesses. And
if they did, what would that look like, sound like?
It would look like bringing, including family members when the patient wants them in physician or nurse practitioner meetings, including them in treatment planning, having family conferences that provide information and support. And I think for many families, adding a medical family therapist to the treatment team, somebody who can help predict what the emotional fallout's going to be, help the family come together rather than having the illness or accident drive them apart, and help them negotiate the medical system, which is can really be very impersonal right now.
Well, Linda, Susan is describing almost exactly what you needed, but she's also describing almost exactly what you're doing now. There's a program at Hospital University of Pennsylvania that you're involved with Dr. Paul Langton.
Well, there are two separate programs, one working with medical students where they're called the LEAP program with Dr. Langton, where they assign a medical student first year to really follow one particular family who's struggling with chronic illness. And they are invited to the family's home. They show up for appointments. It gives them early on in their education not just the sciences that they're struggling to get, but also the understanding of how the family is affected, and the hope is that in the future they will be better doctors for it. And then the other aspect is that there's a requirement now that institutions like the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania include in their curriculum programs where physicians, attendings, residents are all exposed to understanding the needs of families beyond just the medicine, so that they themselves are better equipped to appreciate what the family is going through and to learn how to include the family in the treatment.
The program that you described, this LEAP program, where residents go into families' homes and follow med students, what are they learning? What are they reporting back to you?
Well, first of all, the exciting thing is it's what the families are reporting as well. So the students are reporting that it's eye-opening, that it's why they went into medicine. It's not just the science, but the interest in humanity, and they're learning about the experience of the humanity by getting to know these families, being in their homes, and seeing how they're living with this illness. What's so terrific for me to work with these families is to hear that it's an incredible advantage for them to feel like they have a role in, as one 12-year-old young boy struggling with rheumatoid arthritis described to me, he gets to be a teacher in the situation rather than just a victim, rather than just a patient. He can actually teach these medical students what it's like to live with his disease, and that gives him a lot of status.
It's about being respected and being honored. Susan, is there any research about the impact of chronic illness on children when a parent has a chronic illness? I mean, this is what Linda described. I know she was concerned about her children. I became a quadriplegic when my kids were 5 and 6, and of course there was ongoing anxiety about what does this do to the kids.
And I think it's appropriate. We really need programs for children for siblings when a child becomes ill, and also when a parent becomes ill or disabled. And there are a variety of them, because we know that a child can become frozen at the developmental stage that the trauma happens, say a sibling is in an accident or whatever, and the family then rallies around to take care of the illness demands of that particular person, whether it's a parent or child. And what we want is to be able to help that family, for all the people in the family to move around along developmentally, and anybody to get stuck.
How is that done?
Well, I think it can be done in a variety of ways. There's some very good, for example, groups for children whose parents have cancer. In Rochester, and that's also across the country, there are groups like this. There just needs to be thought in our healthcare system about families and about the siblings of children who are sick, or the children of parents who are sick, rather than only the patient per se. And Linda talked about various ways in which their residents and students are taught. We have in University of Rochester, we also have similar programs. It's really a mindset. Our family medicine residency is oriented around family-oriented primary care. We teach them to include the family in the diagnosis and treatment of any chronic illness, and to pay attention to how the children are doing. We have a whole four-month curriculum around this. There's also programs to have residents and psychologists go from the hospital to the home when someone's discharged from the hospital, to make sure the treatment plan makes sense. And when you go into the home, the resident suddenly learns what the realities are for the family. So I think that we know something about the fact that that illness is a family experience, and we need to organize our health care and our education to match that. And often it's the psychosocial aspects of the illness that are overlooked.
Linda, when we talk about chronic illness, many types of chronic illness are not stable. Most are probably not stable. They are debilitating, and some are fatal. And this adds an extra dimension of stress to the family. I would imagine there's a quality of grief going on at the same time they're living.
It's a constant grieving process, because especially when someone who is deteriorating in their ability to function, both in the family and in the community, you lose something. You lose something every day, every week, every month. You do less. We did less going out to dinner. We did less taking vacations. We always were recognizing our losses and trying to focus on what we did have.
Well, I want to introduce somebody else to the discussion now. Sarah Schaefer sent me an email, I don't recall, maybe a month ago. She has Sjogren's syndrome. It's a debilitating autoimmune disease. She's also got chronic severe pain. Sarah, welcome to the show. We have you?
Yes. Hi, Dan.
How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's nice to hear that you're great, certainly for the moment, I hope.
Yes.
So, like I said, this show is really inspired by an email you sent me requesting a show on the impact of chronic illness on the family. So let's begin with your story. I know it starts off with your being a physician. You're in the Bay Area, and you were taking graduate courses in counseling so that you could transition to hospice work. So
yeah. What
happened?
Well, I was in this kind of early midlife transition of wanting to go into hospice and palliative care, partly due to just a lot of soul searching, and also because I had serious chronic back pain from a car versus bicycle accident where I was the bicyclist, unfortunately. And I could no longer function in the clinics that I was working in and had been confined to administrative work. And I was very drawn to hospice and palliative care for a number of reasons. And I started taking graduate work, but in the middle of all this, I went into an autoimmune crisis. I'd had Sjogren's syndrome building up for many years in retrospect, but I went into a full-blown crisis where I just basically fell off a cliff and became non-functional. And that was 6.5 years ago, and I have really, I tried to work for a little while and just couldn't pull it off, so I had to retire and go on disability, which was a huge blow to my self-image, to my life, to my family. It was just really difficult.
When I asked you, Sarah, how you were, and you said great, can I come back to the question?
Mm. Yeah. I'm really happy to be doing this show, and I mean, I certainly have a lot of challenges and difficulty in my life, and I'm sitting on an ice pack right now because of my back pain, but I think I've learned to really appreciate and enjoy the things and the richness that I can get in life, and, you know, look at the broader picture a lot more than I could early on in my disease, where I was just absolutely overwhelmed by being ill and overwhelmed by the loss, and kind of through a lot of wise teachers and a lot of experience and a lot of hard knocks, I've kind of learned that, you know, you have to do the best you can with what you're given. So
I was struck by your language when we spoke to you earlier.
Mm.
One of our producers called you and you said that your body is out of control and there are no good treatments. And
right.
Then you said that it's very difficult to live with. I'm sure very difficult doesn't quite capture.
No, it really doesn't.
So
yeah.
What are they? What's it like to live in pain?
Well, it's not just pain. I mean, it's people with Sjogren's syndrome, which is, by the way, an incredibly common disease. There are about 4 million people in this country that have it, and no one's heard of it, even though it's a close relative of lupus. But we have incredible, many of us have incredible profound fatigue and are often misdiagnosed as having chronic fatigue syndrome. And it's a flu-like fatigue, so you feel like you have the flu every day, and I have to lie down every afternoon, and if I don't, I pay for it for the rest of the day or for days on end. And so I'm incredibly limited, and I just feel really horrible in my body much of the time. And so I can't escape that. I can't escape the physical suffering.
So how do you get from I'm feeling horrible to I enjoy the life I have? I feel great at the moment.
Well, probably 8 o'clock at night I wouldn't say that. Because I feel much worse in the evenings, and this is my peak positive time of day. So what I do is, like I said, I enjoy the heck out of the things that I can enjoy, and I also have learned to be very proactive in terms of paying attention to reality of what I can handle and what I can't, and minimizing my symptoms and supporting my body in every way that I can. And that doesn't mean I can become well, I can become cured, or that my disease won't progress. But I really do have some ability to affect the quality of my life. And then I also have to let go of the fact that sometimes I do go through these flares of my illness where I have absolutely no control, and I just have to give in. I spent several months this summer 18, 20 hours a day in bed, and it was horrible. But it was what it was, and I eventually got through it, and now I'm kind of, you know, back up to my old baseline, which is not terrific, but it's you know, something that I've learned to live with.
Well, what many of us have found, when you spend 18 hours a day in bed, those 6 hours feel really good.
Yes, they do.
you said that our culture hangs on the restitution narrative. What do you mean?
Well, I got that word from Arthur Frank's book, The Wounded Healer, and he talks about the chaos narrative and the restitution narrative. And basically in our culture, people expect you to either get better or die. It's just not like we have this cultural shadow and denial, just like we have the denial of death. I think you had a show with Irving Yalom a couple months ago, and it was wonderful. But we have the same shadow around denying chronic illness, vulnerability, and fragility in life. And, you know, when you deny that, you deny the person's ability to live in this chaotic life. And what happens is there's this kind of guilt and shame and blame, especially, my God, if you're a physician or a therapist, yeah. you're not supposed to be sick, you're supposed to be a healer. And there's this shame around, I can't control it, I can't do any better. And we actually sometimes get very direct, judgmental comments toward us that we're not trying hard enough, we don't have the right attitude, we're not pulling our weight, we're not just pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps and overcoming something that people think that we should overcome.
Yeah. And we also especially have that, and we haven't talked about this at all. There's one chronic illness that is a major illness, and that's mental illness. And we especially yep. have the shame and blame and stigma going on with that. We're gonna have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about marriage. Your email was about intimate relationships. Lynn, I want to talk with you about the impact of chronic illness on marriage and other intimate relationships. Susan McDaniel, we're going to have to say goodbye to you. I want to thank you for the work you're doing, for joining us. Susan McDaniel is a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at the University of Rochester. She's the editor of the journal Family Systems and Health. She's written Counseling Families with Chronic Illness. I'm joined here in the studio by Dr. Linda Welsh. She's a director of the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Center in Bala-Cynwyd, but she's also co-director of professionalism education at the Hospital of University of Pennsylvania. I'm also joined on the telephone by Sarah Schaefer. She is a physician with her own autoimmune disease, and later on when we come back, we'll be hearing from Kate O'Donnell, another listener from Maryland who sent me an email. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Barack Obama and John McCain don't see eye to eye on the Iraq war.
John McCain stands alone in his stubborn refusal to end the misguided war.
He said the surge wouldn't succeed. It said he couldn't succeed. He still fails to acknowledge that he was wrong.
Will the war play a central role in this year's presidential debate? Join us on September 26th for special coverage of the 2008 debates from NPR News.
Friday night at 9 o'clock on WHYY.
The AMC cable series Mad Men is up for 16 Emmy nominations. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mad Men creator and executive producer Matthew Weiner and cast members John Hamm and John Slattery. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about chronic illness and its impact on the family. I'm joined here by Dr. Linda Welsh. She's director of the Agoraphobia and Anxiety Treatment Center in Bala-Cynwyd. She's co-director of professionalism education at HUP here in Philadelphia. She's author of the book Chronic Illness and the Family. I'm also joined by Sarah Schaefer, who has her own autoimmune disease and chronic severe pain. And Linda, I want to follow up with you when we finish talking with Sarah before the break. The question came up about marriage, intimate relationships. What kind of impact does chronic illness have?
An enormous
impact. It's a deal breaker for most.
Oh, it's a deal changer, that's for sure. And as one of the guests mentioned, it can either make it or break it. And there's an organization actually called the Well Spouse Foundation that offers a tremendous amount of support for caregivers, because the spouse, if there is one, is usually the primary caregiver in the situation. So you have changes, role changes, where one may take over financial responsibility and or may take over just the emotional needs of the children or whatever has been the role's assignment before, changes dramatically when one becomes ill, and you have to kind of reinvent the relationship, reinvent the marriage. And there was one almost ironically funny incident where I was, of course, the primary caregiver for my husband, but when we were in a consultation with a physician, the physician didn't even look at me or address me during the entire time, and I thought, that's really strange, since I probably know more about what medications he takes than he does. So educating the, as we said, the physicians to recognize the importance of the family, but also helping the couple work through the changes in the marriage. It doesn't have to change intimacy, but it often does.
Well, you know, often the well spouse puts everything on his or her shoulders and think they should do exactly more than they are capable of doing, ergo compassion fatigue.
That was my biggest error, was assuming that I had to take over everything and be protective of my husband, protective of my children. And we talked about the impact on the children. I think I was doing them a disservice, and they'd tell me as much, by being tremendously protective. And in terms of my husband, it was a disservice to him to take away what little he had left that would give him the dignity to still be a caregiver himself. So I would not go to him for emotional needs when I really could have.
Sarah, do you have children? Sarah?
Yes, I'm here.
Do you have children?
Yes, I have two teenage sons.
And how do you navigate those waters with them? How have they handled your illness?
You know, I would say that's one of the biggest successes that I've had. I think there are other areas that I've really floundered in, but they're really have been incredible, and I think we already had a pretty, they were 9 and 13, I believe, when I got ill, and we had a pretty strong, authentic relationship when it started, and I was very honest with them about how sick I was and what I could do, but also at the same time, I did not in any way burden them with the details of my agony or my despair, and I told them several times, not repeatedly, but several times, that their best gift to me would be to live as normal of a life as possible. And both of them have told me recently that they feel a little guilty for not feeling worse for me, but they don't feel like it's really hugely changed their life. I haven't been able to travel with them. They've gone on vacation with me, without me the last 6 summers, and that's a huge loss for me. But they still go on vacation, and my sisters took them backpacking, something that I couldn't dream of doing. And, you know, they still go out and live their lives, and yet they understand what's happening to me. So that's been okay. And also realizing that the core of what's important in your relationship is not what you can do, it's who you are and that you love them.
Yeah, that's really the issue, is how you live with your chronic illness. And, boy, it's hard to do that, though. I mean, you know, you talk about living with it, and it sounds like you live with it with grace. It sounds like, you know, I made a joke about how great those 6 hours are that you're not in bed.
No, it's not a joke.
Well, right. But, you know, not everybody can get there. And, you know, it swallows up your life. Linda described it as the terrorist in the room, and it's hard to live with grace.
I definitely had a lot of resistance, a lot of angst, a lot of anger. I was indignant that this happened to me for the first 2-3 years, especially. It's like, how could this happen to me? I have perfect health habits. It just was unbelievable to me. But once I got over my sense of entitlement to have my life look a particular way, I was able to more realistically deal with what I had left. And, you know, it's a lot less suffering. I mean, I still have a lot of physical suffering, and I do get emotional suffering, but you can reduce it.
Yes. Yes, you can. And you can with work, you can with grief, and you can with support. Sarah, I'm going to thank you so much for joining us. We've got to move on and other people. And thanks for your email. I appreciate your listening from way out in the Bay Area.
Well, thank you.
Take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Linda, let's talk about the economics.
The financial burdens that the family begins to face.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it puts a tremendous strain on the family, so that you're not only dealing with illness, you're dealing with medical expenses, you're dealing with insurance companies, you open up a whole new career just in trying to understand how to manage finances, which we didn't have to worry so much about before my husband became ill. So you start to wear many hats as the caregiver, and certainly there's a lot of guilt on the part of the ill patient in terms of what they're able to provide and what they are no longer able to provide, and their identity, how they've seen themselves as a primary supporter of the family.
Don't I remember? I when I first had my accident, those first couple of years, I wondered how low can self-esteem go.
Exactly.
I mean, I felt like I was pushing the limits there. We are talking about chronic illness today in the family. Number's 888-477-9499 at the moment. I'm joined by Linda Welsh, who's a psychologist. She's co-director of professionalism education here at HUP, and she's written Chronic Illness and the Family. Let's go to the phones. We've got Kim on the line. Kim, hi.
Hi.
You're on the air. Hi.
Thanks for having me on your program.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Well, I had a thyroidectomy in 03 and woke up with nerve damage on the back of my head and tried 4 years with a pain specialist with cortisone injections and et cetera, et cetera. And here I am at 08, no better, and have come to find that I have sarcoidosis, which is a little-known autoimmune disease that is in the same family as lupus that tends to attack the lungs, which I luckily do not have lung involvement, but it's attacking my lymph nodes and attacking my joints and attacking probably my nerve endings, which may explain why I've been having so many problems for so many years. And it's gotten to the point where it's ruined my marriage. My husband left me, and I'm having a lot of trouble dealing with the fact that I look normal, and people don't quite understand that, you know, I'm not in a wheelchair. I, you know, can walk around. I look fairly normal. So why does it take you all day to do a simple task? Why do you have to lay down in the middle of the day? They're not quite understanding, and it's hard to explain to them.
What's the impact on you, Kim?
The impact on me, I do try to take care of myself, and I joined it's actually a divorce group, but we kind of help each other in all aspects of our feelings and what we're going through.
Well, you've answered the question I wondered about, and you know, you described the way you fit or don't fit into the larger culture because your illness is invisible,
right?
And I wonder about isolation or loneliness in this process, and you've answered it indirectly by saying that you've joined the support group. Linda, I would think that in a way I'm a lucky guy because I'm in a wheelchair, and people respond differently to me in a wheelchair than they would to Kim, whose illness is invisible.
Absolutely. That's why I think support groups are so important, because only there do you really understand or feel that you are understood. The isolation, the loneliness of the patient and of the family becomes enormous as you become different. But there was one other issue, and that's that people don't want to know that you're not feeling well. It's not just that they don't get it. Often they don't want to get it. They want to not have to deal with it, so they don't ask questions. And they assume that you're fine, and you say you're fine, and it's that end of discussion.
Well, it relates to what Sarah Schaefer was talking about earlier when she referred to Arthur Frank and the restitution narrative, that we want people to either get better, be better, or die.
Exactly.
There's no room for the shadow. Kim, I thank you for your call, and I do wish you the best, and I hope your support systems grow and grow, and you feel less alone in this process. Before we go to break, I want to bring in Kate O'Donnell. I know she's been waiting for 40 minutes now. She's got a completely different kind of story, and I do want to introduce you to her. Kate, you're a listener from Maryland.
Yes, from the Eastern Shore of Maryland.
Yeah, you've got a pretty unique story here. The marriage to the father of your now grown sons ended after 8 years.
Yes.
But many years later, he was diagnosed with Huntington's.
That's right.
Disease. And so how did you learn about his disease, and what impact did it have on you after all those many years after the divorce?
Well, being in contact with the sons that we had in common, I learned that their father, who had rheumatoid arthritis and had had scarlet fever, was deeply depressed for years, and nobody, it seemed to be an unresponsive depression, which led to his being put on disability. And as his condition worsened and became more puzzling, one of my sons was in better contact with him. They finally were able to get a diagnosis, which seemed a bolt out of the blue, that he was in his 60s before he was diagnosed with Huntington's, and he really was only diagnosed because of the genetic testing that became available in 1994, I believe it was, that made it truly definitive as to his not having MS or anything else. He had Huntington's disease.
So what's the impact on you, divorced for so many years?
Well, the impact on me was a shock, because as many as 40 years ago, I was aware of Woody Guthrie having fathered a lot of children. I think they're 8, if I'm not mistaken, and that he died of Huntington's disease. So since I'm 64, I understand the genetics of the hereditary aspect, and I immediately feared for my children who were then in their 30s, and my grandchildren who are now four and two. So I knew what it could mean. It was just a matter of their getting tested and finding out if they were going to be victims of Huntington's disease. And the 50-50 fell exactly that way between my two sons. Fortunately, the son who has his own children was the one who fell in the safe range of the what's called the CAG count. His was down around 17, meaning that he will not get Huntington's, and his children are in no danger of having Huntington's.
And your other son?
And the other son, who recently turned 40, came up with a higher count, CAG count, than his father. So he called me at work one day and said, "Well, I've got it." And that was the beginning of what I think of as our journey as a family to try and deal with this knowledge that he knows what he's going to die from, and he knows approximately within 5 years that he will be incapacitated in ways that nobody at age 35 should have to know that they're going to go down this particular road.
You know, you use the word journey, and journey is a word almost devoid of emotion. So what's it like for you? I'm having trouble trying to imagine that.
Well, they live in California, and I live in Maryland, and much of our exchange of information and contact is by way of email. But I do have conversations on the phone with my son's wife, who is a registered nurse, as it turns out. And my role, I was roleless in this until I educated myself even more about what this was going to mean. And believe me, I have cried copious tears with various people over the knowledge that I may outlive my son, who has Huntington's disease.
And his father has since passed away.
Yes, he did. He had made arrangements for not having a feeding tube. For those who don't understand much about Huntington's disease, you do lose your personality, you lose your intelligence, and their father had a PhD from the University of Kansas and was noted in his field. But he became helpless. I mean, he literally became helpless and was in an acute care facility for, I think, about 6 years, and then went into hospice, and he didn't want a feeding tube. People with Huntington's disease generally choke to death, or in his case, he became resistant to all kinds of antibiotics, and rather than have a feeding tube, which would have kept him minimally alive, he drifted away slowly over 8 days in hospice.
Kate, I hate to do this to you in the middle. We're going to have to take a short break.
Oh, that's fine.
I want to come back and maybe talk about the impact on your current marriage, and I want to expand the discussion with you, Linda, about the healthcare community. And we're talking about chronic illness and its impact on the family and its impact on the healthcare community, and vice versa. My guests are Linda Welsh, who's a psychologist and runs the Agoraphobia and Anxiety Center in Ballykinwood, but more relevant to today's show, she's co-director of professionalism education at HUP, and she has written Chronic Illness and the Family. I'm also joined by Kate O'Donnell from Maryland, who's the father of her sons, was diagnosed with Huntington's disease. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Support for WHYY comes from Freelancers Union, an 85,000-membered nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting independent workers in a variety of industries. More at freelancersunion.org.
Next time on Day to Day.
Hello, everyone.
Recognize that voice?
I'm an exorcist. No, I'm a limo driver. No, I'm an undertaker. Yes, an escapee from an asylum clad in pajamas and a top hat.
Close. He's Brian Unger.
All right, simmer down.
And he brings you his own twisted take on the news every Monday.
Oh, okay.
The Unger Report next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. WHYY gratefully acknowledges our corporate underwriters and would like to add your business or organization to our diverse list of supporters. To become a WHYY underwriter, please call 215-351-1223.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about chronic illness and the family. I'm talking with Kate O'Donnell from Maryland, who's her first husband, the father of her two grown sons, was diagnosed with Huntington's disease, and he passed away relatively recently. And one of her two sons was also diagnosed with the disease. I'm also joined by Linda Welsh, who's a psychologist who's got her own story. Her husband died of renal disease, and she's the co-director of professionalism education at HUP. And she's author of the book Chronic Illness and the Family. Kate, I want to ask you a broad, almost existential question. Most of us humans have certain expectations about what life is going to look like going forward. What was your vision before all this, and what is it now?
Before I knew that my children were vulnerable
yes.
to Huntington's
yes.
disease, well, I remarried 7 years ago, and so the blending of the family had to occur rather long distance, and my vision of the future included spending time with grandchildren and with my grown sons, and adding the component of my new husband. And everybody likes everybody. The problem arose when the two sons of the same father, both living in California, decided to buy a house together and to live in separate quarters, but to combine their families in a way that would allow the son without Huntington's to interact frequently with the son who has Huntington's. That didn't take into account that the son with Huntington's would become difficult to have around. He complained about the little boys making noise and when he was trying to sleep. And personality problems arose that then has estranged them for over a year now. They haven't spoken.
That's heartbreaking.
And I thought the son who doesn't have Huntington's would keep more of an open mind and be more understanding, because he seemed to be very understanding about his father. But it came down to the couple with the children telling the other couple, this isn't working. And it hurt the son with Huntington's terribly.
Yeah, of course. And I can only imagine how it hurt you. So I guess you don't have a clear vision of the future and what it's going to look like.
Well, my vision of the future is very, very uncertain, because Huntington's can affect people mainly physically, with the chorea, the jerky movements,
right.
the involuntary movements. And it can also lead to gross personality change and perception change. And that's mainly what's happened with my son, is that his perception of who's hurting him has made him turn against his wife, who he just adored. Until his personality changed.
Well, I have to tell you, Kate, that you know we've been hearing from our guest experts about what's needed in situations like this, and you know they come back to the same thing, that the family needs to be consulted, and the family needs to be involved, and the family needs to be educated, and I just hope and pray that happens for your family sooner rather than later. Unfortunately, we're going to have to say goodbye to you. I want to switch gears in the time we have left and talk to Linda about the work she's doing. So I want to thank you, Kate, and I do wish you the best. Linda, I want to hear about something called Schwartz Rounds that you're involved with. This is fascinating.
Very, very exciting. There was a gentleman, Ken Schwartz, who developed a fatal disease, lung cancer, and knew that he did not have long to live. But what he received from the medical community in terms of support, comfort, understanding, and he was so appreciative that he set up a foundation recognizing that hospital physicians, medical staff, nurses, all respiratory therapists, don't spend the time being allowed to express their own emotional issues regarding caring for patients, and that by setting up these Schwartz rounds where the hospital team gets an opportunity to talk about their experiences, medical personnel, in caring for somebody with a serious chronic and almost always fatal disease, the impact on them, the way they practice medicine can be so much more rich if they have an opportunity to deal with their own issues. So the Schwartz Rounds consists of the entire hospital community, the medical staff being invited to hear and share their own experience of dealing with patients. Now, I think in my own history, dealing with my husband's physician, sometimes we were really lucky in terms of their understanding, sometimes not. But often, as death drew near, I could see them withdrawing to an extent, and I felt it because we'd had a 20-year history with them, and they were losing a patient and a friend in my husband. And my thoughts were, if they had had an opportunity like these medical people do now to deal with their own feelings, they could ease our suffering, they could hear us better, they could listen to us the way they could listen to their own hearts.
Where is it happening?
It's happening all over the city now. It's happening at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. It's happening at CHOP. It's happening at Einstein is starting up a program. So
is it well received?
Very well received. It's a sellout. So that medical people are hungry, desperately hungry, to be able to deal with their own experience. They're not robots who've learned science. They're human beings who react, become engaged, become involved with, and care. And the better able they are to care for themselves, the better able they are to care for their patients. And that's behind this entire movement to introduce what we call humanism and professionalism into the medical community.
Boy, I have to tell you, I am so pleasantly surprised to hear that it's being so well received. And there's lots of other programs like that happening around the city. So they're hopefully the pendulum is beginning to swing the other way, that we're starting to humanize healthcare.
Very much. And I've always felt that suffering is dependent on the relationship we have with each other and with medicine. Pain may not be manageable, but suffering can be.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. Linda, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Linda Welsh is director of the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Program in Bala Cynwyd, co-director of professionalism, I'll get it, education at HUP, and she's involved in Schwartz rounds all over the city. I was also joined earlier by Susan McDaniels, a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at the University of Rochester. She's the author of Counseling Families with Chronic Illness. And earlier on, we heard from Sarah Schaefer and Kate O'Donnell, who've got their own stories. I want to tell you about something very special coming up on the 13th of this month. We're going to be interviewing surrogates from the McCain camp and the Obama camp, specifically on their issues on mental illness. We'd love to hear from you. Why don't you email me questions? We'll get them on the air, and I will ask them. Reach us at voices@whyy.org, and we'll get your questions on the air. But your questions, I want to be the ones that drive the show. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Paris Luna is the executive producer for radio content. Mike and Scott's the executive producer of Voices in the Family. The show is co-produced by Lisa Walters and Gita Simons. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.